From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob. Wait, what? Brooke?
Oops, sorry. Forgot to turn off my phone.
All right. I know you really have the Star Trek theme on your phone, but we staged this little bit to make a point. The Rocky ringtone came up a few years ago in our conversation with a documentary film director who had to pay thousands of dollars to use it when a cell phone rang in a scene that she could not cut. Many argued that such cultural artifacts should be covered by fair use, a clause in copyright law that allows for limited use of copyrighted material. But filmmakers continue to pay licensing fees for all sorts of ridiculous things.
The print world relies on fair use. An author doesn't think twice about quoting from another book. But Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig says the settlement between Google Books, the Association of American Publishers, and the Authors Guild could carry the crazy licensing practices of films into the print world. On Thursday, all eyes were on a federal judge in New York City who was expected to rule on the settlement, but he said he couldn't because, quote, there's just too much to digest. No kidding. Opposing the Google Books settlement are big companies like Microsoft and Sony, and big countries like France and Germany, and big agencies like the U.S. Department of Justice.
Google argues that by scanning 18 million books, it would help authors by promoting their work and help humanity by building the world's largest online library. And for nearly 3 million books, those that are in public domain, there was no problem. But most books are still under copyright. Google's plan was to scan them, make them searchable, and offer users relevant snippets. If users wanted more, they could follow a link to buy the book. Google figured this setup would fall under the principle of fair use, but Lawrence Lessig says not everyone was having it.
The publishers and the Authors Guild immediately filed a lawsuit against Google, declaring that Google's design to scan books violated copyright unless they had permission from the copyright owner to scan the books, even to make just an index of the books.
Tell me about the settlement of the lawsuit.
Well, when Google was sued, there was a lot on the line because if Google lost this lawsuit, it would be potentially a billion-dollar judgment against them. So they struck a deal that said that a certain percentage, 20% of these books that were presumptively under copyright, would be made available to the public for free. And then if people wanted to get access to more than that, they could pay a certain amount and get access to the full book. So in one sense, sounded great because people were getting access to 20% for free.
But let's talk about the money that people would pay for access to the other 80%. This would not be a profit center for Google. Where would that money go?
It ostensibly goes to a new nonprofit collecting society whose objective is to deliver this money to the authors. But here's the core problem that Google faces that we all face. The vast majority of these authors, I think the estimate is 75% of the books that Google wanted to scan, were books that were presumptively under copyright, but for which the authors, the copyright owner, could not be found. We don't know who they are. They don't even know they have rights. And the basic problem here is that our copyright system fails to tell us with whom we should be negotiating when we're trying to clear the rights to get access to this work. Now, Google's technicians and lawyers were enormously clever in figuring a way around this basic failing of the copyright system. My concern is that their elaborate way around this failure is going to create an enormous range of costs down the road.
And one of the costs that you've identified is that it suddenly makes every quotation from every work a legal matter in which lawyers get involved and money is exchanged, which you think is cumbersome to the point of absurdity. Is that your central qualm?
Yes. I had this epiphany moment when I was taking my three-day-old daughter into the hospital for an emergency evaluation about whether she had severe form of jaundice. And obviously, I was terrified. And I downloaded the article that had an extensive review of this disease and printed it out and was sitting there in the waiting room with my daughter. And I got to the critical point in the article where they had a table that was going to tell me whether I needed to worry or not. And when I looked to where the table was, there was a little passage that said, the rights holder has not authorized the reproduction of this table in this digital form. And it struck me as astonishing that we had already come to the point where we were licensing at the level of a graph or a table inside of a scientific journal article about a disease that, of course, parents and everybody need to have access to information about so that they can know how to deal with that disease. And my concern is what the Google Books project is doing is cementing us down this path.
What do you think is a better alternative to this scheme?
Well, I think the first and least controversial solution here should be that Congress should establish a simple registration requirement, not when something is created, but in order to maintain the copyright. So let's say 14 years after you have published something, you need to register that. And if you don't register that, then you're signaling to the world that you don't care about the copyright and the world can treat it as if you don't care about the copyright. But if you do register it, at least we have a clear understanding of who owns what. The second change is we need to once again think about what the balance should be between free access to culture and metered access to culture, because both extremes are mistakes. Either the extreme that says everything is free, because then lots of people won't create because they can't cover their cost of creating, or the regime that says everything needs to be licensed, because in that world, there's a whole range of creativity. Think of kids producing stuff on YouTube that can't begin to happen because the cost of negotiating and clearing those rights is just so extreme.
Licensing regimes, 18 million books scanned, lawyers, content industries to deal with. Is this a Gordian knot that can never be untangled?
Well, I think that Gordian knots are cut by bold policy action. Peter Drucker often said, there's nothing so bad as doing efficiently that which should not be done at all. And I think that Google has done efficiently something that maybe we shouldn't be doing at all, which is this elaborately complex system for getting access to culture that has no continuing need for copyright protection. If we could fix the problem that Congress created, then I think it's possible to cut this Gordian knot.
That Peter Drucker quotation is great. Now, do you owe him money?
You might, but I don't.
All right, Larry. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Lessig is the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and professor of law at Harvard Law School.
Lessig is worried that the Google agreement will result in copyright creep, changing the ways we can use books for decades to come. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is worried about copyright creep, too, on a global scale. Right now, a multinational body is deliberating terms for the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA. Participants include the United States, the European Union, Japan, Canada, Mexico, and so on. But the agreement doesn't just cover fake Rolexes and DVDs. There are indications that it's also considering new rules related to intellectual property online. Critics worry that important decisions affecting our online lives could come in through the back door because the negotiations are secret. Danny O'Brien is the International Outreach Coordinator for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Danny, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here.
Now, ACTA is an anti-counterfeiting act. So what does this have to do with the internet exactly?
Well, that's a very good question. When this was first proposed a few years ago by Japan, the idea was to clamp down on the kind of loopholes that allow people to trade in fake Rolexes or fake medicines. Unfortunately, the lobbyists in that particular area are also very worried about how the internet is eating into their businesses. They've been hankering for a chance to toughen up copyright law for many years.
The World Intellectual Property Organization, or WIPO, was supposed to ride herd on these copyright issues.
Well, indeed, it was set up as a UN agency to smooth over all of these sort of strange differences in people's copyright laws. Unfortunately, it's been slightly too effective in absorbing the concerns that a lot of people have about how copyright laws can damage the free spread of information on the internet. There are a lot of people now at WIPO, particularly the developing nations, who are actually sitting there saying, no, you know, we actually want a minimalist approach to copyright. That hasn't pleased the people forming this ACTA trade agreement separately from WIPO.
So what is it precisely about this that bothers you so much?
You know, I wish I could tell you, but unfortunately, because it's a confidential process.
Well, what do you imagine might be in it?
Well, there's been a wish list for internet enforcement for a very long time. And the sort of usual suspects, the recording industry, the motion picture industry, have been taking this to every kind of venue that they could find. It's stuff like what they managed to pass in France, Three Strikes, which is a scheme by which if you're accused three times by the recording industry of file sharing, you can be put on a national blacklist and banned from the internet for up to a year. Other examples are laws that ban software that you can use to sort of back up DVDs or undo the DRM. The thing that stops you being able to play the music that you buy from one vendor on another vendor's music player. In countries like Canada, it's perfectly legal to buy and make that kind of software. In the United States, it's actually a criminal act. But really, there's just an absolute grab bag of issues that now threaten to affect people's everyday behavior online.
And if you were to describe the stakes in global terms, what are they?
Well, when do we decide that we're going to place a bunch of laws that govern what we can and can't do on the internet? And in what venue do we decide to do that? Right now, there's a huge debate about these things. And I think the right place to discuss it is in a legislature, is in a public place. That's almost the opposite of what's happening here. No one can get to see this apart from a bunch of lobbyists who then have to sign non-disclosure agreements like it's the new Apple iPad that they're producing rather than an actual piece of law. This will move from being a trade agreement to the law of the land with very little oversight.
You know, it does have the air of a global conspiracy like, the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderberg Group.
I see that all the time, but really, it's inevitable that you're going to get conspiracy theories. I would love for them to come out and say, hey, this is the internet chapter that we have here. What do you think of it? Hopefully, with a little bit more pressure from ordinary net users, we might yet see that kind of document presented.
Danny, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Danny O'Brien is the International Outreach Coordinator for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Coming up, a haven for journalists in the land of fire and ice.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi, Pod People. Katya Rogers, Senior Producer of On the Media here. We want to know what you think about our show, so we've designed a survey and it's on our website, www.onthemedia.org. Please go and take it. It would be much appreciated. Thank you.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Imagine a place, a journalistic haven, where an ironclad shield law protects sources and reporters from having to testify in court, or a state-of-the-art Freedom of Information Act helps assure government transparency, where the strongest whistleblower protection in the world protects leakers, and where First Amendment rights guard against frivolous libel suits. This week, a new group called the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, also known as IMI, proposed legislation that would make Iceland exactly that journalistic haven, to news organizations what Switzerland is to the very wealthy. Why Iceland, perhaps you wonder? It all goes back to the economic crisis. In 2008 and 2009, Iceland's economy collapsed due in part to risky and unethical behavior by the country's biggest banks. Behavior whistleblowers and journalists could not reveal for fear of lawsuits. The lesson, too much secrecy brought down the economy. The editor of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, is one of the principal advisors to IMI. Assange says a leaker risks a year of jail time for sharing secret information about financial institutions in Iceland. That's why when WikiLeaks posted a secret record of a major bank's loans on its site last year, it caused quite a stir.
On July 31st, 2009, we released the largest bank in Iceland's secret loan book to the public. Then the next day, the national broadcaster, RUV or RUV, the BBC equivalent, tried to make the contents of that loan dossier their main news item for the 7 p.m. news. But only 5 minutes before the news was to go to air, an injunction landed on the news desk preventing them reporting the contents of that loan book.
But RUV did manage to get around it by using the period it had intended to devote to the story about the banks to showing images of your website, WikiLeaks.
So this had the effect of directing the entire Icelandic population to the primary source document itself.
Now, it's shocking to imagine that a court would issue any kind of injunction against a financial report, no matter how explosive. Up until that point, July 31st, was Iceland in other ways lacking in certain basic press freedoms?
Reporter Sons Frontiers had Iceland listed in 2007 as first for the defense of press freedoms. By 2009, it had dropped to ninth. It's not that the law became any weaker during that time, rather that the motivation to suppress the press had increased with the greater scrutiny of these rich organizations and individuals who were trying to hide their money or evade discipline as a result of the crash.
So the episode became an opportunity to codify and even strengthen the press freedoms, and the IMI movement began. Tell me what an IMI regime would do to protect journalists and sources.
From one angle, there's the Freedom of Information Act. The last Freedom of Information Act here was passed in 1997, before the internet was really a significant factor. So there's all sorts of opportunities to pull in some of the best modernizations that have occurred in the rest of the world, in Estonia and Norway. And then there's the protection of the rights of a source to stay anonymous.
This you lifted from Sweden's laws.
Yes, the Swedish Press Freedom Act is very progressive. In many other countries, the angle journalists have taken is we want to be protected when we are forced into court. But the angle taken in the Swedish Press Freedom Act is that it is the source who deserves the right to communicate to the public, and the public who deserves the right to know. And the journalist is an intermediary in this process. So the journalist must be protected, but the journalist also has a responsibility to protect. And if that responsibility is broken, the source can ask that a criminal prosecution occur.
I'm curious whether, as you've shopped the aisles of the world's press laws, if you plucked anything from the US shelf.
Absolutely. One thing that we have looked at in particular is some quite progressive anti-SLAPP legislation in California.
Anti-SLAPP?
The idea of SLAPP lawsuits is not to win in the end. It is to soak up time and resources of press organizations.
Wars of attrition waged by people with deep pockets.
Yeah, and in fact, that is the biggest problem in the United States at the moment. For example, Time magazine, in defending its suit against Scientology, spent $7 million and won in the Supreme Court. It was protected under the First Amendment. But which publisher has $7 million spare to take an investigative article all the way to the Supreme Court and spend years and years on it? Even the biggest publishers don't have that sort of cash anymore.
So you've skimmed the cream of media protection and source protection laws from around the world, from the UK, from Sweden, from Belgium, and so forth, with the idea of benefiting Icelanders or of, in fact, becoming a haven where journalists from around the world could take refuge to do their work without fear of government interference.
Some people say haven, but we want to aim for heaven. Yes, it's actually possible to use a law in one jurisdiction to strengthen the press in another. For example, we were involved in a case in South Africa where the South African Competition Commission released a redacted report on cartel behavior in the South African banks. We then released the redacted portions, and a prosecutor was appointed to go after our source. We used the Swedish and Belgium law successfully in that case to argue that the investigation team in South Africa was at risk of becoming party to a crime in Sweden and Belgium. People don't want to risk that, and they don't want to risk fighting that out in court, or having their assets seized overseas, or having problems when traveling. That's the reason source protection and other protections of the press can have positive effect in jurisdictions around the world.
Now, you talked about heaven. I'm afraid I have to ask you about hell. I wonder if a regime of blanket protection for journalists and those who are legitimate sources wouldn't also protect those who would wish to hide behind these impregnable shields to create mischief, whether it's libel or blackmail or simple journalistic irresponsibility.
You have to remember, there are not absolute protections. For example, malicious libel is not protected against in the new package of laws. And, I mean, what country is suffering from too much press freedom? Can you name the country that is actually at risk of having too vibrant and free press? There is no such country.
Let me ask you how the initiative is going. The proponents need 51 votes to pass in the Icelandic parliament. Where do you stand?
The proposal has just been filed, and there are over 20 names on it from every party in the Icelandic parliament, including the two parties that are in the governing coalition. And the politicians tell me this will sail through.
Well, Julian, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bob.
Julian Assange is the founder of WikiLeaks.
This past December, journalist Sebastian Jones was watching MSNBC when he saw a familiar face, former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge. Ridge was on the TV show Hardball, arguing that President Obama's economic plan ought to include more money for nuclear power.
I'd like to see the president take his green agenda and blow it out of the box. Let's build nuclear facilities. Investment tax credit would do it, but why not set up an infrastructure bank? Let's create the nuclear power plants.
What viewers weren't told was that Ridge had been paid more than $500,000 in executive pay and another $250,000 in stock options by a nuclear power company called Exelon. MSNBC identified him as just a former governor. Sebastian Jones wondered whether this was an isolated incident or if lobbyists often posed as unpaid experts on cable news shows. He conducted a four-month study that was recently published in The Nation. Welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
So I'm guessing this wasn't an isolated incident.
That would be correct. We started in 2007 as sort of an arbitrary date, keeping tabs on when we would see people who were not being properly identified, who were working for companies in their day job, but then were going on MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, and discussing policies that related to the companies, sometimes even the companies, frankly. When we were all done, we got to 75.
75 regular, unidentified spokespeople presented as disinterested experts?
Right, exactly. And one thing that I found, and this is something that Terry Holt, this one Republican strategist, told me, was that, you know, he tells all the networks he goes on, he says, you know, here are my clients. And he sees this as being completely ethical. You know, you inform the network, and then the network decides what information they use to identify you. And so it's basically this major systematic oversight that then results in these folks going on without any sort of disclosure there.
Any pushback from cable viewers? Are they even aware of it?
I've been pleasantly surprised with the reaction that we've gotten from people who actually watch these networks, particularly because The Nation is a somewhat liberal publication.
Somewhat liberal publication?
Right. No, it's a progressive publication, and we've had many people who've gotten in touch who have been shocked by some of the things that we reported. The day it went up, two of the first people to link to the piece and write about it in a favorable manner, a writer for the libertarian-leaning Reason magazine and a writer for the Washington Examiner, which is a conservative publication. And I think that really does sort of go to the point that this is not a problem that is isolated to one political party or to one particular network. It's a problem that is systematic and that needs to be addressed in that kind of way, not simply let's get one guy off TV or let's fix this one conservative or liberal network. It's something that all of these networks have to deal with in a manner that both viewers and those of us who monitor the press more closely can see that there's actually some action being taken.
Sebastian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sebastian Jones is a freelance writer based in New York.
Squaring off in the power grid, Democratic strategist Julie Roginski and Republican strategist Terry Holt. You both have 20 seconds to make your case. Mr. Holt?
Well, I think the politics are convenient to go after hedge fund managers, but the more likely person to be affected here is a group of people who are developing real estate in your average hometown who pay taxes there. And the Congress thinks they're going to raise $24 billion over 10 years.
That's Terry Holt in one of his innumerable appearances as a conservative cable news talking head on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC. He certainly has the credentials for it. He's worked as a spokesman for House Minority Leader John Boehner, as a national spokesman for the Bush-Cheney 04 election campaign, as communications director for former House Majority Leader Richard Armey, and as senior advisor to the Republican National Committee. Currently, he represents an array of clients, including the lobbying group of health insurers called America's Health Insurance Plans, or AHIP. Holt says he always informs cable talk show producers of his relevant business interests. And he says, while the shows reliably inform viewers of his political career, they are less consistent when it comes to revealing his lobbying or public relations activities. We called CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC seeking comment on their disclosure policies and practices. They all declined. As for Holt, he would prefer that TV viewers were always informed of his various lives.
It's extremely important that if I go on television and I talk about health insurance reform, that people understand where I'm coming from. And that's why I've said that I believe disclosure is crucial in that circumstance. But in the vast majority of the political programs and on the political topics I discuss, they aren't on issues per se, they're on politics. I'm going on today on CNBC, for example, to talk about the stimulus package. I don't have any direct client interest in that topic. They're inviting me on because I'm a Republican, because I have a particular predictable view of government spending programs. So there's no real need in that case to tell the American people that, you know, I have X or Y or Z client.
Do you think it's the responsibility of a guest to disclose their lobbying ties?
I would leave that to the guests because everybody is in a different situation. Most of the folks that were mentioned in Sebastian's article were more lobbyist than public relations type. And there is a difference there. I think it might be a shade of gray for most observers.
I have to say it's a shade of gray for me. You are getting paid to articulate their point of view.
That's exactly right, because as a public relations person, I'm in the business of relating publicly. And so most healthcare reporters know that I am affiliated with America's health insurance plans. It's just good business. And that's why I go back to the point I made about the difference between a lobbyist and a communication strategist. Lobbyists do take particular positions on specific bills. And in those cases, it's extremely important that they tell people where they're coming from, because I think at that point, there are potential conflicts of interest on particular pieces of legislation.
I have to say, in all honesty, that I'm not buying the big difference here between lobbyists and public relations people, because the fact is, in very simple terms, what people are expecting when they watch these programs is that people are arguing the case on the basis of the merits and not because of any financial gain.
But you said that people expect these guests on these shows to
be judging the issues on the merits.
On the merits, right. I think that that's not my job to judge it on strictly on the merits. I'm being asked for my political analysis, and politics is way more than just merits. It's sometimes perceptions. You know, there's millions of different factors in determining whether something is politically viable or not.
So you're saying that the public, in watching cable news programs,
right,
ought to have, should have, probably does have an expectation that they're going to receive bipartisan spin?
I think balance is really important because, you know, the nature of political debate is opinion.
But you're saying more or less fact-free bipartisan spin.
I would always say that your arguments are better if you're using facts to make them, right?
But they're optional.
But facts are also part of a broader perception game that's going on around political issues.
Since I think what you're saying is that the producers, the guests, and the audience all understand that these are gladiatorial shout fests, I guess it doesn't really matter all that much if anybody discloses anything. You already know what side they're on when they walk in. What difference does it make how they got there?
Well, that's an argument that could find some adherence. I think that when I have a client who has a direct interest in what I'm on television talking about, that I at least tell the producer. If the producer chooses to use it or not, I think that's ultimately a decision that they make.
You've had a long career in politics. Do you ever wonder why you go on these shows?
Well, when I first started doing campaigns, I wanted to win them and I wanted my issues to prevail. And I still like that, but I have become more satisfied with being part of a good process. I'd rather have a fair election than win an election. I like to have the debate, and I think that most people understand that you don't win a debate by litigating it on television, that this is a bit of theater.
Right. Do you ever feel, for lack of a better word, just kind of icky?
My goodness, no. I have to represent my views. I have to come up with valid arguments. I tell people all the time, it's better to be liked than to prove your point, especially on television. You're going to be more persuasive over time if you avoid the shouting and you be respectful to the other side. The political debate is by its nature partisan, and I actually relish that.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Terry Holt is a lobbyist, a public relations professional, and for the purposes of this interview, a Republican pundit who frequently appears on cable news talk shows.
Coming up, heroes where you least expect them, uploading YouTube videos and stamping library books.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day. At wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The winners of the George Polk Awards in Journalism were announced this week. There were a lot of familiar names, 60 Minutes, The New York Times, CNN, but there was at least one surprise. That would be the award given to the anonymous person or persons responsible for the video of the death of 26-year-old protester Neda Aga Sultan. John Darnton is the curator of the Polk Awards. John, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Now, this is already an iconic video, and this is going to be very difficult even to listen to the description of, but please tell me what it captures.
Well, there are, in fact, two separate videos. One is about 8 seconds. One is about 40 seconds. In the longer one, you see a young woman, dark-haired, kind of collapse backward, and several men rushing to her aid. She falls upon the street, and a stream of blood starts appearing, first, I think, out of her nose, and her eyes kind of roll toward the back of her head. So there's a very vivid and rather grotesque shot of her precisely at the moment of death, I think.
Now, apart from how graphic and horrible and dramatic this footage is, it was also one of the very few video windows into what was going on in the streets of Tehran. Is that what caught your attention, or was it just the violence itself?
No, it was not the violence. It was the fact that this one piece of video footage seemed to rise above all other means of getting news out of Iran to the outside world. We had quite a few print entries in this category. They were all quite good, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. But in a strange way, they all almost canceled each other out. That is to say, none of them rose above the others. And then in thinking it over, we thought, well, what does one take away from that dramatic period of street protests? And what stuck with me and with others was the memory of the footage of the death of that rather brave young woman.
Now, I don't want to diminish the power of this video, but I must ask you this. If I see a bank robbery through the glass of a window and dial 911, I am a good citizen, but I'm not a detective. If the person who recorded this was simply a civilian who happened to be in the wrong place at the right time, does that make him or her worthy of a journalism prize?
Well, that is the big question, isn't it? The George Polk Awards, after all, are means of honoring professional journalists. Throughout our 60 years history, that's what we've done. But in this case, we felt that it was time to, in a sense, say, we're all in a new world now. Yes, there are professionals out there, but there are also people I call bystanders who are capable of recording important events, in this case, just with a camera and a cell phone, and transmitting it to the outside world. There's no reason, if what they actually send out there has news value, that they should not be considered, I think, for an award. There have been previous awards. A Pulitzer went once to an anonymous photographer, also, incidentally, shooting inside Iran.
Yeah, that was Jahangir Razmi, who photographed another iconic violent image of the firing squad deaths in the wake of the Iranian Revolution. He was a photographer in the employ of a newspaper when he took those photos.
No, I recognize that. And in fact, if you look at many of the iconic photographs of the past, the burning of the Buddhist monk in Vietnam, the execution by pistol in Vietnam, Kent State, they were all taken by recognized professional photographers. This is different. This is a kind of backhanded recognition that so-called neutral platforms like MySpace and YouTube can actually serve a powerful function in disseminating news.
That said, should we professional journalists, whatever that means, should we feel slighted that an award has gone not to journalistic rigor, but to doing the right thing in a serendipitous circumstance?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should feel slighted at all. In fact, with all of this material bombarding us constantly now, we're more in need of professionals than ever before to help us sort through it. There is a danger in this new world in which anonymous footage can get instant worldwide play, and that is you must have a sense of the provenance of it. Now, in this case, it is very clear that this is not staged footage.
Finally, John, you have awarded this prize to somebody's. Have you or the rest of the committee given any thought as to what effect this is going to have somewhere in Tehran?
I have no assurance of this, but I would like to think that whoever did take the footage and whoever uploaded it might hear of this award somehow, might feel secretly that they made a very valuable contribution to the world's understanding of what was going on. And meantime, we will hold a plaque without a name or names on it. And if in the future some claimant can come forward and support the claim, we would most gladly honor them with it.
All right, John, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
John Darnton is an award-winning journalist and the curator of the George Polk Awards.
Just about every week, a TV news segment or magazine cover scares us with the prospect that new media technology is damaging our brains, our social skills, and our culture. But if you take a long look back, you would see that every new technology, including the magazines and TV programs now scaremongering about the web, were also once regarded with deep suspicion. In an article in Slate this week, Dr. Vaughan Bell, a clinical psychologist at King's College London, reviews some historical highlights of hysteria's past. Dr. Bell, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Can you begin by talking about Conrad Gessner?
Well, Conrad Gessner was a very famous 16th century Swiss biologist, most renowned for founding the science of zoology. But what he was also interested in doing was cataloguing every book in existence in the 16th century, which he sat down to do and eventually wrote the Bibliotheca Universalis. Through this process, he became absolutely outraged at what he called the confusing and harmful abundance of books which had flooded the 16th century world through the invention of the printing press. And he called on the kings and princes of the time to solve the problem and regulate the book trade.
And you skip ahead a few decades, maybe a century, to the wide circulation of newspapers, and there was a similar worry about information overload.
Yeah, I mean, this was a big concern at the time. The French statesman, apologies if you speak French, I shall call him Malus Herbis, kind of railed against the newspaper. He felt that it was causing people to be isolated. He criticized newspaper readers as spending their time in a sullen silence and was concerned that this damaged society and took people away from getting their news from the pulpit, which is where the kind of wholesome news came from, or so he said.
Was anyone worried about the effects that radio would have on our brains or our attention?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, whenever these scares come about, it's usually scares about children. When the radio arrived, there were a huge number of articles discussing the fact that, you know, kids spent their time huddled around the radio, were neglecting their schoolwork. They couldn't sleep at night because of listening to all these dreadful radio programs. And this was kind of disturbing their fragile minds.
At one point, schoolwork was considered to be a danger to fragile minds.
It was considered to be a serious danger. I mean, there was a huge amount of debate about the fact that compulsory schools were taking children away from their natural development. People were concerned too much study would strain the mind and damage the brain. And there was a huge amount of concern among psychiatrists at the time. In a very famous book by a British psychiatrist, Pritchard, on Treatise on Insanity, he had excessive studying as one of the main causes, moral causes of insanity.
So could you run down the current crop of fears related to the newest new technology?
Well, of course, this is almost all based on kind of the internet now. And on a fairly regular basis, every week, every month, you'll see quite shocking headlines. I'm just having a look at a few of them now. This is one from CNN, which says that emails hurt IQ more than pot. This is a story from a British newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, that says Twitter and Facebook could harm moral values, scientists warn. Facebook and MySpace generation cannot form relationships. And one of my favorites is from the British paper, the Daily Mail, which is famous for its bad science headlines, how using Facebook could raise your risk of cancer. And only last week, they warned that the internet rewires the brains and makes teenagers vulnerable to mental illness. Now, of course, none of these stories have any serious science behind them, and yet they regularly make huge national and international publications.
In fact, you cite a study, actually it's a meta-analysis, and it comes to a surprisingly different conclusion from the headlines you just read.
Yeah, so I mean, a meta-study is a study that looks at all of the evidence to date and mathematically aggregates it to see what the overall effect is. And this was a study done recently by the National University of Education in Taiwan. And they looked at all of the studies on the internet use and psychological well-being, and they found that the internet was associated with a change in our well-being of less than 0.1%. So the best evidence to date shows that these things really aren't doing us any damage. And yet, time and time again, we see these fairly scary headlines appear in the media.
Did it surprise you that the very same fears seem to recur? New technology, no matter when, no matter where, shortens our attention span, degrades our social ties. Socrates complained that writing things down was bad for your memory.
Yes, I mean, he also warned parents against telling children improper allegories. I have a lovely image of young Greek children behind the chariot shed swapping dirty allegories. This doesn't mean to say that every technology is harmless. There's quite a bit of evidence now that the amount of hours spent watching television by very young children is associated with a delay in their cognitive development. But very few of the scare stories they get in the media are about television, because that's kind of an old hat technology now.
You end your piece with a paraphrase of Douglas Adams, the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And he observed that technology that exists before we were born seems completely normal. Anything that someone invents before we turn 35 is kind of exciting and new and shiny. And anything that comes after that is treated with suspicion.
And the beautiful thing is you can extrapolate back to the ancient Greeks.
Yes, and I can extrapolate forward. You know, when I'm 40, I expect to be tutting and worrying about my children and the young people because something they're using is really not to my liking either.
Dr. Bell, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Dr. Vaughan Bell is a neuropsychologist at King's College, London. Marilyn Johnson claims that even in the age of Google and smartphones, certain human beings, namely librarians, can still get you better answers to your questions. In her new book, called This Book is Overdue, How Librarians and Cybrarians Can Save Us All, she argues that the age of Google is also the age of information overload and the digital divide, so libraries are more important now than they've ever been. The librarians in Johnson's book are a far cry from the buttoned-up, bespectacled stereotype. Rather, they're on the forefront of technological change. They bravely face down the government, and they know their way around a dance floor. Most important, says Johnson, librarians not only provide patrons with accurate answers, but unlike search engine algorithms, they help people arrive at the right questions. For example,
it was a real patron who showed up at the desk saying, "I need some help finding information about Buddhism." A series of questions later, it turned out it was not about dancing with an emphasis on a certain part of the body. It was about the religion Buddhism.
The librarian didn't bat an eye when asked to look up Buddhism.
She would have happily looked up Buddhism if that had been the true quest.
A central thesis of your book is that librarians are frequently better than computers to get you the answer that you want. This kind of reminds me of the old emblem of the industrial age where the horse is trying and failing to outrun the locomotive. Explain to me how librarians manage to outrun the locomotive.
Librarians know a whole lot more than we do about how information is structured, and they know ways to get around the Google algorithm that throws up all this repetitive information, some of it bad, and they know how to assess it. They have access to fabulous databases, and they know about resources that are in a kind of gray area that we don't have access to on our computer. It's an illusion that everything is there, digitized at our fingertips. That's so not true.
How are libraries doing now? We do know that as localities cut their budgets, library hours are getting reduced. Are the numbers of patrons being reduced?
More and more people are not only using the library, they need the services of a librarian to help them weave their way through the bureaucracy, to help them figure out how to get food stamps, how to get help searching for jobs. More and more students are turning to the libraries as more and more school libraries are shutting their door and letting the librarians go. And yet, we're cutting them drastically. It is really a tragedy that the economic stimulus package doesn't put more money into libraries because, you know, librarians are really economical. They are not expensive resources, and they are helping put this country back to work.
We've talked on this program about the Patriot Act. The FBI claimed the right to come in and search patron records, and there was an anonymous case brought by Connecticut librarians. Can you tell me where it stands now? Are librarians still battling to protect the patrons' privacy?
Where it stands now is exactly where it stood when this case came up. The FBI still has the right under the Patriot Act and all of its revisions to request patrons' information from libraries, and the librarians are not permitted to reveal that they are being asked about this. The story of the Connecticut librarians trying to defend their patrons from what they viewed as a violation of their constitutional rights is the stuff of thrillers. They had to sue the Attorney General of the United States. They could not tell their spouses. They could not tell their children. They could not tell their library boards that, in fact, they were suing the Attorney General of the United States.
They lost.
They lost. The case was dropped, but they won in the sense that they were able to talk about it.
So while you sing the praises of librarians, you also detail some of the wacky behavior that some of them have. You encountered some sort of amazing dance done with library carts.
Groups of librarians from various libraries across the country, actually around the world, they get together and they perform a sort of music video with library book carts as the centerpiece. They have them whizzing back and forth. They spin them on one wheel. They dance on top of them.
Where did you see it?
The one that I saw was in Washington, D.C., in this huge hangar-like space at the annual convention of the American Library Association. Librarians had packed the place and were screaming and cheering.
Audience, are you ready?
It was more fun, I think, than I've ever had.
You also talk about librarians who have blogged about some of the really quirky behavior of patrons.
Quirky is a nice word for it. Public librarians deal with the public, and there's a lot of cleaning up.
That was a very strange chapter in your book, people leaving poop on library shelves.
Rogue turds, as one librarian termed them. It turns out to be a universal. They have this problem in New Zealand. They have this problem in Japan. People want to make something, you know, not books.
Marilyn, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Brooke.
Marilyn Johnson is the author of This Book is Overdue, How Librarians and Cybrarians Can Save Us All.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Bill Bowen.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.